Hi, I'm Wayne McPhail, and I was one of the people that originally started the Rabble Podcast Network, and I think that you should support the Rabble Podcast Network and Rabble.ca because there's no other place where you're going to get such a diversity of voices speaking truth to power.
Show your support by going to www.rabble.ca/donate.
Listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. You could be listening live or possibly on one of our wonderful and very appreciated community partners all the way across the country as well now into the United States. Some of our international listeners or local listeners as well who are listening on the podcast, all appreciated equally. Totally equally loved. So we're going to be talking about a couple of things today here on the program. I'm sitting in studio currently with M.A. Ma and Brenna Owen. We're going to be talking largely today about the TPP. This, of course, is a very timely issue because we are about to get stuck with it if we don't hurry up and do something. Now, why would you say do something? A trade deal is super innocuous. Well, we're hopefully going to find out some of the very specific and very carefully thought out reasons why you might want to have a second look if you're not concerned about the TPP. And we're gonna, don't listen to us on this, you don't have to take our expertise. We're gonna be hearing from Gus Van Harten, who's the associate professor at Osgoode Hall Law School, as well as the author of Investment Treaty Arbitration and Public Law. There are some very specific reasons why we think that you should learn a little bit more about the TPP, and I'm concerned. We're going to find out more about why Gus has some reservations with the help of MA and Brenna a little bit later. But before we get to that, I also have another guest on the phone who will be joining us in just a moment. Her name is Lauren Brown, and she is the Education and Outreach Coordinator for LEAF, which is the Local Enhancement and Appreciation of Forests. Before we just get to that, and I'll just wait until my technician lets me know that Lauren is on the phone as well, that we got a whole bunch of email this week, and I'm going to be responding to it this a little bit later in the show as well. But this week it was mostly fan mail, so you're not going to hear Stefan and I doing a rant this week. However, it appears to be popular. I was sort of skeptical, but we actually got quite a lot of comments about our last couple episodes that people really enjoyed. So, and I personally enjoy tearing down nonsense, but I wasn't sure if other people wanted to hear me do it. But apparently they do, so we'll be doing more of that in a second. And I'm just waiting. Do we have Lauren on the line? Not yet. Oh, that's right. So in the meantime, while we're just waiting to get Lauren on the line, Emmy, do you want to give me a little bit more background about what we're going to be talking about with Gus a little bit later in the program?
Yeah, so we're really looking forward to this section. We're going to talk a little bit about the implications of what's happening with the TPP and how it really has potential impact in the Canadian setting. This is a huge multilateral trade agreement that's on the table, and there are maybe some specific implications that as Canadians we need to be concerned about. We at least need to have some knowledge. There's been a number of surveys done that show that Canadians really aren't aware of what the TPP is or what it contains.
All right, so perfect timing. Thank you very much for that, Emmy. We'll get back to that shortly just after the first break, but now I believe I have Lauren on the phone. Lauren, are you there?
Hey, Darren. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Our pleasure. Thanks for joining us. So just a little bit, because before we get to why we've invited you on the program today, because you have some cool programs coming out that we thought people would like to know about, I want to know a little bit about you and your background. So just in case people haven't heard of LEAF before, do you want to just sort of explain who you are, what LEAF is, and how you came to work with them?
Yeah, for sure. So LEAF, it stands for Local Enhancement and Appreciation of Forests. And we're a nonprofit organization dedicated to the protection and improvement of our urban forest. And we do that through a variety of programs that we have, such as our backyard tree planting program. We have tree tours, workshops, presentations. And I'm going to be talking about a new program that we have coming up today on the show. But actually, how I got involved with LEAF, I actually started out as a volunteer. I took the Forest Conservation Science program at U of T. And at my time as a student there, I was just looking to get some more hands-on experience in the field and thought, you know, LEAF was the perfect place to go, seeing as I grew up in the city and, you know, my love of nature, I could get that through LEAF. So I spent some time volunteering there. Yep.
No, I was going to say, when I was in university, I lived in a co-op house. One of the first times I met some of your volunteers was when they showed up in a truck to come inspect the trees in our house. So it was really fun. Sort of very, very hands-on.
Yeah, really. There were volunteers coming to check out your trees?
It was somebody with LEAF t-shirts. Either that or they found a really good scam to get into our backyard.
Maybe they were following up on like the backyard tree planting program or something.
Yeah.
So yeah, I got involved that way and a position ended up opening up. And basically I handed in my last paper at U of T and then I started working right away with LEAF. And then I did take a break and I've been back for almost a year now, just under a year. Yes. In a similar role that I had previously. So in education and outreach.
Great. So would you like to tell us a little bit about some of these, some of the general programming that you do and then some of the programming that you're just launching?
Yeah. So like our backyard tree planting program is something we have in the fall and spring where we have one of our arborists would come, you know, give you a consultation in your backyard. This would be for homeowners. And we help you select the best tree species and where the best spot it could go in your backyard. So we do plant only native species because, you know, they've evolved to thrive in our conditions we have here in its native environment. So that's one of the focuses of that program and everything we do with planting native. And on my side with LEAF, I'm involved with most of the educational components. So we believe that educating people about the benefits of trees and how to care for them is really going to help improve our urban forests through that education. So we have things like tree tours. So that's a walk through a neighborhood and it's led by an expert and you might, you know, do some tree ID and learn about some of the stresses and along that walk that the trees have in our city. But one of the new programs that we have coming up and what I'm on here today to talk about is our Young Urban Forest Leaders Program. So it's specifically designed to provide young women from ages 18 to 24 with hands-on experience in the field of urban forest and also community engagement. So there is research published in the Journal of Arboriculture that there's a low representation of women in the industry, so it's approximately 10%. So we're hoping, like, through this program, we can play our part in trying to increase that number.
That seems shockingly low. Do you have any reason why that might be?
I see it like, you know, this also includes all of our tree care service field. So that would be, you know, tree climbers and people who are doing work, actually like physical work on trees. So I think on that side of things, it is primarily dominated by men in the industry. Mm. And you see a lot more females in more of like the community outreach. But I think that's where the number comes from. But I don't think it's not taking into account people enrolled in programs in like universities and colleges, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm. So how, what sort of things are you looking to train these mostly young women in? This is the education about the tree specifically, getting sort of a gateway to get people interested in the field. What's the deliverable at the end of this?
Yeah, so there's sort of three different areas. They're going to receive hands-on skills in arboriculture, community organization, and public outreach. So the first thing that participants would do is partake in our tree tenders training program. And that covers things ranging from tree biology to tree identification. They learn about Toronto tree bylaws that we have in the city. our threats and benefits to the urban forest. They learn how to plant trees and mulching and everything with regards to tree care and maintenance. So that's sort of like the background for trees and the urban forest there. And then after that, participants will be broken up into teams, and they're going to be working hands-on with a park group, so a community group that's involved with their local park. And the young women are going to be helping do a whole tree inventory of the park and assess sort of the health of the trees and help this community group develop and adopt a park tree program for their park. So it's working with the community that way, and ultimately at the end of, it's a 6-month term that they'll be getting mentorship, is to launch a tree tour and stewardship event at the end of that.
Awesome. So that's largely going to be, that's something obviously that's available for the people in Toronto. Are you aware of, can you help people link people up to other organizations, or is there any resources you might direct people to if they're not in the Toronto area and they're interested in getting involved?
For this specific program, it is just funded. We have funding from the City of Toronto and the Toronto Rotary Club, so it's specific to residents in Toronto. We do have our backyard tree planting program and our tree tenders training program in York Region, Ajax, and potentially this year Mississauga. So we do branch out to those other areas for those existing programs. Mm-hmm. But for now, with the young urban forest leaders, it's just specific to Toronto.
Okay. Well, unfortunately, we're running a little bit tight on time here. I have one final question for you, other than to simply mention that those are some programs that Leaf are running. I'm sure there are other organizations across the country if you're interested in those types of things. I'm getting some nods from inside the studio. That absolutely is. So if you're in southern Ontario, perhaps reach out to Leaf, and they might be able to help you find a program.
Yeah, we're taking applications by March 20th, so that can be done online at our website, yourleaf.org.
Sure. So just really quickly here as well, I wanted to ask you a little bit more. We'd spoken before we actually got on the air a little bit about something a little bit more general, and you'd mentioned that there was some policy change that you were interested in. So we've only got about 2 minutes left, but I wanted to give you a chance to address that.
Thanks. I mean, where I can really see a change could make a big difference is in sort of like new development construction practices. So currently what happens in new development areas, typically just outside or around the GTA, the topsoil, so the top 12 inches that's taken thousands of years to develop, that's completely removed and stripped. And post-construction, a minimal layer of soil is put back in place, with a lot of fill just underneath. So we're losing a lot of that valuable soil in our, you know, new house area. So we lose a whole capacity of soil that we could plant trees in. And soil is the life for all plants and trees. And if you don't have actual space for soil, there's nowhere like roots can grow. And soil also, you know, prevents water runoff into our stormwater system and retains water and its habitat for a number of organisms. So I think if there was a change in place, I don't know exactly what it would look like, but, you know, something to help protect at least part of the soil from these areas that are being newly developed.
All right. Well, I'm afraid that is all the time we have but I want to thank you again. That was we're speaking to Lauren Brown, who's the Education and Outreach Coordinator for LEAF, which is the Local Enhancement and Appreciation of Forests. Thank you so much for your time, Lauren.
Thanks, Darren.
Awesome.
Bye.
So we'll have links to the website there if you are in the Toronto area or in the sort of southern Ontario as well, and you want to find out about those programs, especially if you are a young female that wants to get involved. They are actively seeking. They have programming specifically designed for you, and I encourage you to check it out. We'll have links on the website as well. But now we're going to go to Edward, who's
Hello.
Faithfully sitting in the tech room today, who's going to let us know what music we're going to listen to before we come back and speak to Gus Van Harten about the TPP. So, Edward, what are we going to play now?
We're going to listen to A Generous Man by Dante Matas.
Perfect time. Nice job, Edward, with the win. Nice fade in. You're listening to the Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. We're listening live, possibly in the Toronto area, to the radio station. Could be listening on one of our wonderful partners, which as of recently is including Rabble. Thanks to Rabble for carrying us as well. The podcast is viewable on there. The longest version, though, the only place to get the bonus content as well as off our own podcast, off our website. So if you're hearing this somewhere else and you can't get enough, you're not sick of us just yet, go to greenmajority.ca/podcast. And there is some additional bonus content on our own podcast stream, which today is going to feature one of our volunteers, Sabina, who's going to be walking us through. So because we're dealing, it was interesting, actually, like Sabina proposed this. So we're walking through about to be what is a somewhat complex topic, something that Sabina is not super familiar with. So she is going to play our layman in the bonus show and ask us a bunch of questions of things that, you know, sometimes when you're fairly familiar with something, you're not, it's not obvious what might not be obvious to other people. So that should be really interesting. So if any of this goes over your head, definitely get the podcast, because we're probably going to, Sabina's probably going to help you out after. But without further ado, I'm now going to pass it over to my co-host, Emma Ma, who is going to introduce our guest.
Yes, we're very pleased to have Gus Van Harten on the show today. He is an associate professor at Osgoode Law School and a leading expert in international investment law and arbitration, amongst other things. Gus, welcome to the show.
Thanks a lot, Emma. Nice of you to have me.
So, Gus, I'm just going to launch right in because there's been quite a lot of coverage of the TPP this week. Chrystia Freeland, our Minister of International Trade, signed the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement in New Zealand yesterday. And one thing that has been consistently messaged by the government is this signing does not equate to ratification. So I want to ask you, what is the significance of our government signing the TPP? I assume we are now a party to the agreement. Are there any legal implications for us as a country?
There would be very limited legal obligations, in essence, not to undermine the agreement. But the agreement can't enter into force until a certain number of the original signatories of the agreement have ratified it. So it's true that there's still opportunity for Canada to avoid being part of the TPP if the government decides not to ratify it.
Right, and I want to discuss that aspect a little bit further with you. So when we're talking about ratification or enshrining it in Canadian law through passing legislation, to what extent do countries have any leeway, so to speak, to customize their ratification to their own legal or constitutional framework? Is there an element of having some leeway, or is it basically a take-it-or-leave-it scenario?
It's basically take-it-or-leave-it. Some multilateral conventions allow countries to place reservations to their joining of the convention, but the TPP really doesn't allow much scope for that. So if the really big decision will be whether or not Canada ratifies it. Once Canada ratifies it, assuming the U.S. ratifies it, it almost certainly will come and enter into force. And then it will be binding on Canada as a matter of international law. Passage of our own implementing legislation doesn't really affect that too much from an international point of view. We're still on the hook for the liabilities that the TPP would carry if we didn't follow the obligations it puts on us.
Right, and the public has raised a lot of concerns about this. Experts like yourself have raised concerns that we are signing on to a very stringent trade regime, and that one of the major concerns is that will it impede the ability of our government and other signatory governments to act in the public interest for fear of being sued. So, for example, to take policy action in the areas of environmental protection or public health. And there's been a lot of commentary on the so-called ISDS, or Investor-State Dispute Settlement Mechanism. I think they actually threw the word resolution in there for the TPP. So can you comment on, you know, why raise the alarm in relation to the ISDS and other provisions that are contained in this particular trade agreement?
Well, the ISDS acronym is just like a nice way of describing a radical change in international law that was instituted, started to be instituted about 20, 25 years ago, and has become, you know, relatively widely used by big companies and usually very wealthy individuals to challenge decisions that countries have made at the international level. And it was radical because in international law, disputes are usually resolved between countries, between states. And ISDS puts into the treaties that the countries, that their governments, allow into the treaties a special right for foreign investors, which effectively usually means big multinational companies or very wealthy individuals to have special protections, essentially for their property rights at an international level. So it's functionally similar to just putting a new and exceptionally powerful property rights clause into your constitution.
Right.
And those kinds of clauses, when they're interpreted by people who aren't that sympathetic to the kinds of things that you and I and many of your listeners would care about, protecting the environment and health and so on, just because the orientation of those people, those property rights clauses can be very dangerous for governments. So when governments take action in a whole range of areas of public interest, because it can create potentially massive financial costs for governments that otherwise would not exist under country's constitution.
Right.
So that's sort of the broad strokes challenge that ISDS creates for making decisions on behalf of the public. It's this potentially massive, uncapped financial liability for governments. There's another aspect of ISDS which I can get into, and it's the lack of a judicial process, but I think that's a bit different from the main deterrent it creates for government.
Right, and I'm just going to ask you to speak up slightly, Gus, since we're having you call in today, just to make sure our listeners are hearing you loud and clear. One of the terms I believe you used in one of your articles was that this can be prohibitive in terms of regulatory innovation. So would that, for example, mean that if a national government wanted to put in a carbon pricing mechanism, that could be challenged under sort of potential loss of profits or actual loss of profits for an international corporation?
Well, it could certainly be challenged. And the question for the government would be, you know, how serious is the challenge? What's the risk of losing? And these treaties, they give rights to foreign investors using very broad language. So it's hard to predict how that language is going to be interpreted. And the arbitrators who have been interpreting these kinds of provisions in smaller existing treaties have interpreted these clauses very broadly to favor the foreign investors' point of view. And so I think that's, actually, can you bring me back to your question?
So I guess, I think the challenge that perhaps we're talking about is that if the Canadian government or other levels of government wanted to execute a policy in the public interest, whether it's about the environment or health or whatever, and they may reconsider executing that policy if they actually think that they're going to be sued. So there could be a chilling effect, would you say?
Right, and you mentioned the example of carbon pricing. Right. So let's imagine you have really big established players who want the existing status quo to continue because they make tons of money from it. Let's imagine, say, huge multinational oil companies or other resource companies that have a business plan entirely linked to our existing dependence on fossil fuels, which we know we have to transition out of. We have to transition into the green economy. Those established players, some of them are going to, we can predict, are going to fight that. They are fighting it. And the ISDS mechanisms give them an extraordinarily powerful new tool to fight it because they can bring an international claim against an entire country. Anything that country does at the federal level, at the provincial level, at the municipal level, if there's big enough money at stake, it'll make sense for the big companies to spend money on the lawyers and attack what the government is trying to do. In fact, if they get wind of it behind the scenes, of course, they do it behind closed doors first and try to sway government officials, by talking to them, their lawyers, their lobbyists. And this tool is particularly powerful because the claims can lead to a monetary award against a country that can run into hundreds of millions, or in some cases we've actually seen awards of billions of dollars. And I don't want to get into all the details of why that's something new, but in Canadian domestic law, there's just no way you can get that kind of monetary penalty against the government when it does things like passing legislation or even making court decisions.
Yeah, so this is opening us out to that kind of risk of being sued. And I think Canada has the dubious honor of being one of the most sued high-income countries under the current trade agreements that we've signed. So we know that we are actually vulnerable as a nation to this kind of litigation. And if I understand it correctly, the TPP, these cases are actually going to be outside of our judicial system. So as you're saying, held in secretive tribunals rather than through the public court system. Is that right?
Yeah, and the most important thing there, I think, to understand is imagine that you have a Supreme Court for the world that only protects the property rights of foreigners, which is primarily big multinationals and sort of 100 millionaires. But instead of having judges in the court, you have private lawyers who get paid very well for sitting on tribunals, and they're called arbitrators when they sit on the tribunals. And they don't have the usual protections of independence that judges and courts have. So as a result, for example, they get paid by the appointment. So they appear to have a clear financial interest in having more claims brought. And in this system, it's somewhat unique in that only one side can bring claims in the arbitrations, and that's the foreign investors. So you can identify a business interest of the supposed judge in actually encouraging claims and having the claims take a longer amount of time and so on. It would be totally unacceptable from the point of view of judicial independence in any country mm-hmm. that's governed by longstanding conventions of the rule of law and so on.
And you've done some groundbreaking work, I think, to address some of these potential threats or risks to the sovereignty of the state, if I can call it that. And your body of work on carve-out clauses as it relates to climate change, could you just tell us very, very briefly, how would a carve-out clause on climate change work in the multilateral setting?
Okay, well, the first point we need to understand is no treaties in any field are anywhere near as powerful as these trade and investment treaties. So environmental treaties, human rights treaties, anti-corruption treaties, et cetera, have nowhere near the enforcement mechanisms and the potency of these foreign investor protection mechanisms. So in the fall, there was, of course, this meeting in Paris to try to do something to organize an international response to climate change. And that's part of that is developing multilateral agreements that, in an ideal world, would oblige countries to meet certain carbon reduction targets and carbon mitigation and so on. So what happens when a country's commitments in an environmental treaty like that are challenged by a foreign investor under an investment treaty? Because, of course, the investment treaties allow foreign investors to attack things that countries do, including implementing things that they've committed to do in environmental treaties. So what I did is I just wrote a clause with the strongest wording I could possibly come up with the help of some friends. And the clause would have made very clear that anything countries did to implement their commitments in the climate change agreement could not be challenged using these very financially risky investment mechanisms that would be available to the big oil companies if they wanted to play hardball and really attack what countries and governments were trying to do to address climate change. So that was the idea, was to try to avoid this potential threat that these very generous, unique foreign investor protections pose to important regulatory initiatives that, at least in my view, are a much higher priority than protecting the value of the assets of foreign investors.
So that would prevent a multilateral trade agreement like the TPP, for example, taking precedent over measures that were executed under an international climate change agreement, for example.
It wasn't my proposal wasn't even that broad and that ambitious. I was actually just wanted to stop the foreign investor ISDS claim.
So it was specific to the ISDS.
State-to-state dispute settlement would still be possible under the trade agreements if one country thought that another was somehow abusing its role in implementing an environmental agreement to get some trade advantage. So state-to-state was left in place. It was just taking away this novel and quite radical power that big companies have to frustrate things that governments need to do.
So in a way, you know, when governments are signing these trade agreements with one hand and then climate agreements with the other, there's an inherent or potential conflict there. And I think the European Parliament actually anticipated that and drew on your work by passing a resolution in the fall. Is that correct?
Yes, it was adopted by the European Parliament and added to the European Union's negotiating position at the Paris Convention. But it didn't get put into the ultimate multilateral convention. And to me, that wasn't particularly surprising because I knew it was very strongly worded. And as a result, that the governments, the major governments that unfortunately put the interests of multinational oil companies at a higher level, evidently, than coordinated international action to address the climate change issue. You know, that they weren't going to go for that kind of language. But it was a way to make the point clear how the priorities are being drawn. And I mean, I'll add to this, since I started studying this stuff when I was a law student in the late 1990s, I was struck then, and I'm just constantly reminded how much the priorities appear to be totally out of whack in what governments insist on having in international agreements and where they make the agreements strong and where they make the agreements weak. The protections afforded to multinational companies and very wealthy individuals who qualify as foreign investors are almost incomparable to the relatively weak mechanisms that are in place in almost every other area of international law.
And I want to talk about that in the time we have left in terms of what are the implications specifically in the Canadian context. And you alluded to this, I think, a little bit earlier in our conversation. You know, I want to unpack a bit of the legality of the measures that are in the Trans-Pacific Trade Agreement. We've seen, for example, some court cases that were mounted by First Nations that have affirmed the government's duty to consult First Nations and Aboriginal title. In the Canadian setting, do you see precedents that have been set that way eventually or potentially coming into collision with some of the provisions that are in trade agreements like the TPP? For example, if companies can prove that if the duty to consult First Nations doesn't go in their favor and the governments take decisions because the duty to consult says a project can't move forward because that's what First Nations have said, for example, could you see that being the basis of a case and the Canadian government being sued?
Oh, for sure. Could very well be the basis for a case. For example, you could have a Canadian court that annuls a permit or a license that's been issued to a resource company because of a failure to meet the requirements of the duty to consult. And that's a constitutional duty, but in international law, a country's constitution is, to put it simply, is not an excuse for avoid your international obligations. So as a result, those court decisions could lead to potentially very large financial awards and penalties levied against Canada as a country, because the resource company, if there was enough at stake, they could go to one of these arbitrations, and it's hard to predict what the arbitrators would decide. Every case is different, but there's enough examples of arbitrators being very hawkish in favor of foreign investors, and really, to my property rights enthusiasts sort of run amok with the incredible power that they've been granted over the public purse by these treaties. So certainly that's a very good example of an area where Canadian constitutional norms and values could very much collide with the international obligations to protect foreign companies, and that collision could end up being very costly to Canadian taxpayers.
So that really highlights what's at stake here in terms of our constitution and the fabric of our legal framework here in Canada. I'm going to open this up a little bit for the last few minutes. I have my colleagues Brenna and Darren here in the studio to see if they have any questions or comments for you, Gus.
Yeah, I mean, what comes to mind for me also, hello, Gus, I'm Brenna.
Hi. What
comes to mind for me is perhaps like not as technical as some of the questions that Emma was just asking you, but the fact that Emma had said, you know, the TPP is going to make it difficult for the government to act in the public interest for fear of being sued. So we think about people who are very anti-government, who are like libertarian or, I guess, small-c conservative. But really, so they would ostensibly support something like the TPP, which is putting the power of corporations over individual choice. So there's just this inherent like paradox where individual choices and ability to lobby and influence our governments to make decisions that are favorable to citizens, it's just completely at odds. And another kind of element of that dialogue is that I've done some reading about how the TPP is actually going to result in job losses for the United States and Canada and other signatories. So I'm just trying to wrap my head around where support for this agreement is coming from.
Well, I try to wrap my head around it too, because if I talk to someone who doesn't make money from these agreements, an ordinary member of the public, business person, after about 20 minutes, they're really quite shocked often about what they hear about it, and certainly not supportive. So how is it that these extraordinarily complex and technical agreements get drafted? And by the way, the devil is in the details with these agreements, kind of to the hundredth degree. I mean, the devil is really buried in the details of some of these agreements. And it can sometimes take me a few weeks to sort through a complex text to really find, aha, that's where they hid this new problem. So why are these things written this way? And I don't really know, but I think it probably has something to do with the special access that's granted to the negotiations and to the decision-making process, to the lawyers and lobbyists, the kind of legions of lawyers and lobbyists who work on behalf of big multinational companies.
And I think
it's almost like if you wanted to write a new constitution at the global level for countries that was extraordinarily favorable to the status, the financial position of big multinational companies, this is what you would do.
Yeah, and I think also just quickly, these agreements, perhaps particularly trade agreements, are written and almost have the benefit of being necessarily written in legal language so that they're completely opaque to people who don't read legalese. Because I would call myself a climate organizer, and I think even a lot of my friends who are otherwise extremely informed about things like free, prior, and informed consent and pipeline fights and legal cases are just, we're uninformed about how significant the TPP could be if it comes into effect in Canada.
That's right, and I have the great luxury as an academic to spend years studying this stuff. By the way, most of my colleagues work in the area because it is quite lucrative. And when you go public on some of the problems, it doesn't necessarily help your potential career as an ISDS arbitrator. But there are more and more specialists who really just want to be academics in the field. The way it works typically is someone like me will go and say, look, there's a problem with these agreements, and here's what I think about it. And you've given me a lot of time to describe some of the issues. But of course, I'm just scratching the surface on this show. But then, the government or someone else will put up sort of a lawyer in a suit who sounds good, who will just reassure everyone that everything's fine and point to some, for example, they like to point to exceptions in these agreements. I don't want to take up any more time, but that's a really bad sign if someone's pointing to exceptions in a trade agreement to protect the public interest and the right to regulate. But it takes a long time to explain. So the opaqueness of the treaties helps with selling the treaties because you can't get at the real problems in a credible way in the time you typically have to speak to a public audience because it gets reduced often to short sound bites and short little snippets of quotes.
All right. Well, Darren, Gus, this is Darren jumping back in, the host. I'm afraid we are up against the end of our time, but I want to thank you so much for joining us today. You've helped shine some light on some of these, as you said, devil details. And as you also said, there is a lot more to know about it. This is just sort of one angle on some of the major problems that people should be concerned about. So we really appreciate your time, Gus. Thank you so much.
My pleasure, and thank you for having me on your show.
Absolutely. Have a great day. So for our audience, we're going to take our second final, music break. We'll be back. Stefan's in the studio as well. We're going to have a quick wrap-up about some more of the thoughts of the TPP. I also was building up a little bit of vitriol while we were talking here in a wholehearted agreement, but I didn't want to pretend that it was a question for Gus. So we're going to go to the music break. We'll come back. I've got a little venting to do, and then we'll talk a little bit more generally about the TPP. A couple more news items. We got a couple pieces of fun email as well, which I'm going to mention. And Sabina, one of our new volunteers, is going to join us in the bonus show afterwards to do a little bit of review from some of the more basics of some of this stuff about what some of the concepts or some of the ideas that people may be having trouble with. So without further ado, Edward, joining us again, what are we going to listen to, buddy?
All right. We got Ain't No Sunshine but Matt Anderson. I've seen him live, much better live, so I'm not sure how it sound. But he is touring across Canada, so...
But we also know better than to play live clips from YouTube, don't we, Edward?
Yeah, we do. But we're going to play.
Because there's no time delay. Yeah. And we don't have a bleep button.
Yeah.
All right, and we are back. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful community radio partners. You could be listening on Rabble or on the podcast, which if you are... You have a slightly extended show, so stay tuned for that. But if you're not, we're getting down to the last few minutes here. So I wanted to make a couple quick comments about that interview. I didn't think it was fair to make Gus sit on the phone while I pretended that I had questions that were really statements, so we're going to do that really quickly now. And also Stefan here is joining us right for the last final bit as well and for the bonus show. So maybe Stefan and I'll take a quick stab at it, and then we'll open it back up. We've got about the last 10 minutes or so here of the show. So really quickly, I mean, you know, Gus is, of course, a lawyer, and we've had some other guests. I'm totally embarrassingly blanking. Michael Richler, I think, was a previous guest we had. Anyway, another lawyer from Australia. I'm sorry, I'm blanking. Rimmer, Matthew Rimmer, joined us from Australia a little while ago to talk about this. It's very heady stuff, and a lot of the people who know about it are lawyers. And I'm not one of those people that likes to make lawyer jokes. Lawyers are people too, but they are very technical. And for the same reason, and for a very good and specific reason. And so for the same reason that I think scientists sometimes need a bit of PR help. You know, I think everything Gus said was right, but I just want to say it again, but stronger. Anyone that thinks that this deal is not a direct assault on our democracy is not paying attention or is making money off it. How's that for a mic drop, Stephanie?
The mics are actually attached. You can't drop it.
Yes. If there was a way for these mics to drop, it would have dropped. Here you go. That's my simulated mic drop. It's absolute nonsense. So here's a bunch of reasons that I think it's absolute nonsense. So for one, again, having a lot of fun with this. Mm-hmm. For one reason it's absolute nonsense is that, well, think about it from at the basics. Think about it at the very basics. So as far as this, as we said, there's a ton of things to find disagreeable here. But at its very core, what it's saying is that a country's right to pass laws that it sees are fit. So, you know, what we like to casually call here in very technical terms, democracy, is unfit for this duty. And that there should be a superseding power. And that power is anybody with enough money to have access to these types of things. So any large company, any very rich person, to say, I don't care about your democracy. You're going to cost me money and you don't get to do that. And so some of the things Gus was talking about there was, you know, about making exceptions for this or that. And I think that's great. I think if we could actually have a serious, honest discussion about this in a way where actual facts and evidence could be at a public, actual public airing and a public discourse and really think this through. What does this actually do? I think that would be brought up. And I think Gus is sort of taking it in good faith in the sense that if that was the case, here's this process that I would suggest. But I also think that he's certainly aware that that's probably not what the people who are involved in this are thinking. If profit. So here's the argument, right? Tell me if you've heard this one before. Here's the argument. We should let go of some of our local democracy, because when the planet GDP grows, when these big companies make more money, it trickles down. Remember this? Sounds familiar. Mm-hmm. It trickles down and we all get richer. Great. So if you could actually make that case, why do you need to force us? Why do you need to take the authority away from us? Is it just that you're too lazy to make that case, or is it that you know that that case is false? Because it doesn't. Everybody knows that the more money you have, the easier it is to make more money. Donald Trump has been bankrupt 7 times, and it's been shown that the amount of money that he has now is actually less than if he had taken the money that his daddy gave him and left it in a very simple savings account. Donald Trump is a terrible businessman, and yet he has billions of dollars and is currently running for president. This is a very screwed up system, and we're about to give even more of this authority away from governments. Citizens anywhere, anyone anywhere, should be concerned, unless you have at least $100 million or more. You should be really, really upset right now. I think I vented as much as I need. Stefan, go ahead and jump in.
Okay. So this is what really interests me about this entire conversation. First is that there are a few parts of the TPP that are not a part of something that already exists. What are we talking about when we talk about the ability for companies to sue states? That exists. All the other parts, that arguably the one part that actually really, the two parts that people should really, really be concerned about outside of environment is what it will do to pharmaceuticals and and intellectual property. If there's a part of it that sort of, if you want, whatever MSF is against something, I feel like the world should be against it, because MSF just wants to keep people alive.
It's a guideline, not a rule, but yes.
yeah, exactly. But so what interests me so much is NPR Planet Money. Generally, NPR, lefty bastion, it's called Planet Money. And they, the day or two after this was released, they had a show on this. And listening to that fascinated me. Not because they were like, this is the greatest thing ever, and not because they were like, this is the worst thing ever. Because they were like, yeah, it's a pretty standard trade deal. I think I generally support it. And that was what they had to say. They spent 20 minutes dissecting it. And nothing to see here. Well, that was so fascinating about it. It really was this sort of, yeah, this just makes sense. I'm still struggling to this day to sort of combine the two sides of this thought. I'm still struggling to this day to sort of understand one side that can be just, yeah, this exists, and the other side being like, no, this could ruin everything. And that dichotomy is fascinating. Emmy wants to talk.
Yes, I do. I just want to build on what you're saying, because I think there are a few important things to really bring to the forefront. One, this doesn't replace existing agreements like NAFTA. It only adds to them. Mm. So, for example, Obama's then like, well, we've put some positive environmental protections in, or labor protections. There's a carve-out clause for tobacco. Anything that's in NAFTA still holds. So this is not anything that could be touted as being an improvement is not an improvement. It just increases the number of corporations under different national banners that can sue Canada. That's what it does. We've just added a 12-party agreement to the folks that can actually sue us. And, as Darren was saying, this just gives increasing access to big corporations. This is about maintaining the establishment. It's not about encouraging innovation or small entrepreneurs or anything like that. You really need to get to the bottom of things. You need to look at who's set to gain. What is the structure that is in place promoting in this case?
Well, it doesn't just not do it. It actively fights against it. It actively sets the rules against innovation. Right. Like it's a direct assault on everybody that's not a millionaire or like a 100 millionaire or a multinational corporation. I mean, it's like, so here's another thing. Right. So people will say, well, what would an excuse be? Well, OK, well, we don't want you passing some silly climate change, or let's take climate change out of it. We want you passing some water quality law, because that might cost Nestle some money and then they'd have to fire people. OK, if you think you can make the case that it is net better, even for the water quality thing, we'll make so much more money by letting Nestle do whatever they want, and that will be so good for everyone that it will actually be cheaper to let them do it and pay to fix it later, the water thing, than it will be to pass the law. Great. If you think you can make that case, then make that case. Don't take that decision away from us. So, I mean, here's what's really happening here is the reason, in my opinion, and I'm making a claim here. I don't have evidence. This is an opinion. Let me put that right out in front. This is an opinion. I don't think anyone that's involved in this actually believes that. I think that what actually is the case here is that, like, we have a whole bunch of recent victories. We have recent pipeline fights. We have a whole bunch of actual seeming like it might actually lead to actual progress on climate change. And these are the rich and powerful people and the rich and powerful companies going, fine, you outmaneuvered us this one time, so we're going to go and do this other thing to make sure that no matter what you do, we're going to get paid either way. So you go ahead and have your climate agreements. You go ahead and protect your citizens, and you're going to pay for it because I'm going to sue you and there's nothing you can do about it.
So, like, I'm going to at least in mildly disagree in that
please.
Makes, mostly because I don't really think there are that many people out there who are evil. The way I would characterize what is actually happening is there's a whole bunch of Canadian companies who want to be able to be like, hey, I want to go be able to build, I want to be able to sell my auto parts to Korea as cheaply as possible. And so they lobby our Canadian government, being like, "Hey, we want to sell auto parts to the Koreans cheap as possible." Then Korean auto part manufacturers say, "Hey, we want to sell it to Canada as cheap as possible." And they're the ones who are talking. You know, the real conversation here is localism versus globalism. That's the conversation.
But just to jump in for one second, here's why I don't buy that. It's because then you don't keep the deal secret for a couple of years until it's almost ready too late. That is knowledge. That's a plan. That's not an accident. That's a plan.
And I agree in somewhat with the scenario you're providing, Stefan. But I think we picked the wrong sector there in terms of our auto parts sector. Manufacturing has really, really suffered as a result of these trade agreements. But I agree. I think who stands to gain? Well, big pharmaceuticals, so not the generic companies, but the big pharma and resource extraction companies. So I think we are looking at the result of a very powerful lobby in this country. Those are the sectors that have the funds to add a lot of lobby power, and they have those connections. Certainly, there were very clear links to the previous government, and those links were made clear through like the Duffy trial, for example.
All right, so we've only got 2 minutes left, and the two people who've spoken the least, and I just cut Stefan off. So Stefan, final comment for the on-air, and we'll move this to the off-air, and then we'll see if we can sneak in Brenna for an on-air. But if you're listening to this anywhere but our own podcast, go find the podcast, because this discussion will continue in the after show. Stefan.
I guess my final thought is a plea to really actually sort of like let's have the like I understand to sort of try to understand all sides of this, because I think if we're going to win people over to actually, you know, to agree with us, we have to understand the other side. Like and you have to be able to you can't make a good argument for the TPP, you probably don't understand it well enough to make a good argument against it.
I'm not saying they're all evil. I'm saying there's a couple evil people and the rest of them have Stockholm syndrome. Brenna.
I would just kind of implore people who, you know, first of all, the deal does not even mention the words climate change. So for my environmental organizing friends, learn about the TPP for that reason. And it's been lauded as a 21st century trade agreement, but it doesn't mention climate change. Secondly, for people who are not as concerned about climate change, like, look at it from an economic perspective in terms of job losses and economic opportunities being, like, moved to other countries, as well as, you know, a whole host of other individual choices. So that is why I would encourage people to.
Fabulous. And to be continued in just a minute on our bonus show. Go to greenmajority.ca/podcast to find out more. You've been listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM, one of our wonderful community radio partners on our other podcasts and with Rabble. Thank you so much. Have a good green week, folks, and we'll see you all real soon.